You're listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast from the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm John Spencer, Chair of Urban Warfare Studies at MWI and host of this podcast. Today's guest on the podcast is Brigadier General Guy Hazzout. During the war against Hamas after October 7th, he served as the Chief Learning Officer for the IDF Ground Forces. 2 days after the attack, he was asked to establish and lead an operational lesson learned center. The organization gathered information from units before they entered Gaza, from formations still in combat, and from commanders immediately after they came out. They distributed vital lessons learned in real time across formations. Their purpose was to turn battlefield experience into knowledge that other units could use before they faced the same problem. That mission is especially important in urban warfare, where every building, street, tunnel shaft, and civilian movement can change the tactical problem. The enemy watches, learns, and adapts as well. A military, therefore, has to do more than just collect lessons after a campaign. It has to identify what matters, verify it, and move it across the forces while the fighting continues at the speed of urban warfare. General Hazzout is also the author of a new book, New Guard, No Guard, How Israel Built the World's Most Advanced Military by Dismantling Its Own Ground Forces. The book examines the imbalance that developed between Israel's high-tech capabilities and the ground forces it still needed once a major war began. Sir, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John, for giving me this distinguished platform. I just want to emphasize that although my book is now being published in English edition, it was originally written in Hebrew before the war. And unfortunately, it predicted the disaster.
Yes, sir. And I highly recommend the book. As you know, I wrote a foreword, honored to have some amazing reviews already, but I highly recommend it to all the listeners. All right, sir, before we discuss the lessons learned system that you built, what exactly was your role as the Chief Learning Officer for the IDF Ground Forces? What authority did you have? Who did you report to? And what were you expected to deliver?
Well, when the Chief of Army called me, he understood that October 7 meant a long multi-arena war of a kind Israel had not experienced since Yom Kippur War. During 1973. And in war, the learning competition between the IDF and its enemies on the battlefield will play a decisive role, both in our ability to win and, of course, in our ability to reduce casualty. The mission he gave me was to establish an operational learning system for all the ground forces and the command and command it. Formally, I reported to General Yadai, the Chief of Army, but in practice, I work with all the division commander, regional command commanders and corps and service commanders. Once the senior IDF commanders recognize the value and contribution of the call unit to the war effort, every door opened to me and to my people. Effectively, I was given completely freedom of action to deliver what was required. Synchronize learning across the ground forces, conduct structured wartime learning process for ground forces in every theater, in the south, in the north, and even in the center command, to improve units' readiness for maneuver, make maneuver operation more effective, and focus force development process during the war, especially for what we didn't prepare before the war. So it was very complicated to do it in short time, but we have some advantage that I will clarify.
Was this a position before the war, or was it a role that was created after October 7th?
Well, the IDF actually had similar system in the past, established as a lesson learned from the war in Lebanon in 2006. It was reestablished after October 7 based on existing doctrine and personnel. My challenge was to reorganize everything, implement the existing doctrine and breath life into people and the process.
All right, sir. So what did an ordinary day look like for you once on the ground during operations in Gaza? Where were you physically? Who were you speaking with? And how did information reach you from units in combat?
Well, once the ground maneuver in Gaza began, I divided my time between units and HQ in the field, the Southern Command and also the learning center that we built close to the arena. Mornings were usually dedicated to discussion and situational assessment regarding our learning process and the center workflow. I approve learning materials before before we distribute and work with my subordinate to decide where to focus the learning and what materials to produce. In the evening and at night, I was in the field from battalion level up to the division HQ. And of course, there were some days when I went with my people directly into the combat zone to learn firsthand what was happening on the field. Information reaches us in different ways, through a daily situation assessment with the learning officer in the division and the corps, through daily situation assessment with the division commanders at the Southern Command, through phone calls with unit commanders after success or unfortunately failures, through after action review, AAR, that were written and sent to us. Sometimes the information flowed to us, sometimes we took the initiative to pull it in. In some cases, we went down to the field ourselves to conduct the brief and learn. We even employed an officer who took part in the interrogation of Hamas POW, which were an extremely important source of information for learning.
I bet. How much of your time was spent with the commanders before they entered Gaza and immediately after they came out?
Well, John, this was my most important mission, and my people and I invested enormous effort in it. The rule was clear. No unit will enter combat without a full day learning workshop focused on lessons from the fighting in Gaza. I was extremely strict about this event, and I insist that I personally lead it and that all of the unit's commander attend. Over 2 years of war, I think I conducted more than 100 such sessions. As for commanders coming out of combat, my people and I made sure to participate in the learning session they conducted, summarize them, and send the insight to the other unit. In addition, there were commanders I made point of sitting down with one-on-one in four eyes.
Yes, sir. So you were asked to establish this Ground Forces Operational Lessons Learned Center, we might call it a call, only 2 days after the October 7th attack. What did you do first, and how did the center look during that first week?
Well, you're taking me 3 years back to one of the most difficult and challenging weeks that I ever had in my life. During the first week, most of my effort went into establishing the HQ and the landing center at the base close to the Gaza front, place that called, it's near the city of Ashkelon. The work was mainly logistical, recruiting personnel, defining procedures and process, and deepening our understanding of the doctrine. Fortunately, the person who had written in the IDF the doctrine agreed to come and advise me and my people, even though he had been out of the service more than a decade. After establishing the center and the learning operation room, the next challenge was to create a learning network with all the regional commands responsible for the war's theater, with the corps, and of course, with the services, Air Force, Navy, that was part of the net. But the most important element in the learning network we built were the units in the field, the division and the brigades. The basic principle of the network was every unit and every professional body in the military will have a learning officer connect to us, passing knowledge to us and receiving knowledge from us. Once I had a learning center and a learning network was established, we turned to our first mission. And our first mission was very important one, an initial investigation of October 7 failure. There was a total chaos and no one, not even those who had fought on the field, understood how it happened. It was clear to me that an initial cross-cutting investigation would have a great value, not only professionally, but also moral. During the time I went into the field, after 4 days from the attack on October 11, I think, I see firsthand what had happened in the Israeli community around Gaza. The scenes were horrific. On the one hand, they shocked me. On the other, they made me clear that my decision to return to service after retirement and to take on such an important role was the right decision, both morally and, of course, professionally. And I selected a team of investigator, very professional one, who collected information from every possible source. And 1 week after the massacre, I traveled among units and HU across all the IDF to present the lesson from that initial investigation. We also held a very important joint learning session with the Northern Command to apply the lesson from the failure in Gaza envelope toward better preparation in the Galilee Heights against Hezbollah. Simultaneously, we prepared a professional readiness kit for a reserve unit mobilizing for the maneuver. It includes intelligence on the enemy, past lesson from fighting in Gaza from Operation Cast Lead and Clifted Edge, and professional lectures. Over the 2 weeks before the ground maneuver, my people and I also participate in some briefings and force preparation to closely study the operational plans and get to know the unit commanders.
That's amazing, sir. How quickly did your initial assessment of the October 7th lessons and providing those even to Northern Command produce changes within the units?
Immediately, I used my professional relationship with General Gordon, who commanded the Northern Front, and in phone call, I simply passed him all the lessons and recommendation for preparation in the North. In addition, over 2 days, together with another senior officer who worked with me, we divided the Northern Front into two sectors, East and West, and went from unit to unit. We gathered all the commanders in the field and present the lesson to them. It was very important. Northern Command's rapid preparation and implementation of the lesson from the failure in the South were a significant factor in Hezbollah's decision not to join Hamas and invade the Galilee. This is what I believe.
Yes, sir. Okay, so once you establish the learning center and the learning officers in all the units, how did you decide which observations were local experiences and which were the lessons that should change the behavior of the wider force?
Our operational learning concept was built around four layers, using existing knowledge, first of all, and then preparing forces before they entered combat, and after they get into the field, real-time learning during combat to improve the maneuver. And the most important thing for me was operational innovation that emerge from operational friction and from unit developing creative solution. I always look for the innovation because that was what generated creative solution to the operational problem Hamas presented to us. For example, in one unit, they developed a new TTPs technique for fighting debris dense area. I wanted every other unit to know about it because this was the first time that the IDF in the ground engaged with totally destroy urban city. We didn't have it before. We also focus on our learning along defined access. Warfight and TTPs were, of course, the most important lines of effort, but there were other important ones. The enemy and civilian population, safety, weaponry, command and control, and of course, the core specifics lesson. As the fighting drag on more than once, 2 months, 3 months, we also expanded into learning about values, resilience, and combat stress reaction, everything related to the fundamental human element. We even use special research that the American did after World War II. What are the influence of long-term fighting in the battlefield on unit? And it was amazing because it was knowledge that we didn't have before for the IDF because, you know, for the IDF, one of the principle up to our war doctrine is to do a short war because we don't have economic to support long war and we don't have human resources to support long war. And we quickly understood that there were many risks that threat both the learning and the process and the trust in the learning system. The biggest challenge we faced was information overload, and we did not always handle it successfully. Establishing the system and its success created contagious energy and culture of learning. Everybody want to be part of this, and it's led to a huge volume of products and overloaded commanders. The second risk was focusing on secondary issue instead of what really matters. And the third risk was knowledge failing to reach the tactical edge as the maneuver pushed deeper. When the units were close to the border, it was very easy to bring them the materials. When they came into the center of gravity of Gaza, inside the city of Gaza, it became one of our big challenges. Bad lesson was also a big risk because they were based on inaccurate information or lack of doctrinal expertise. Breaking the chain of command and control, it's easy to be tempted to bypass commanders when you want to push lesson down. We tried not to do it. We tried to avoid matching knowledge to the wrong customer. Getting this right is an art. Getting it right prevent unnecessary information overload. We have a big tension between quality and speed. We need to manage this tension. And the last risk and very dangerous one was the information security. Unfortunately, some printed materials that were taken into the field were left behind in the combat zone and fell into Hamas' hand, and Hamas knew how to use it.
Yes, sir. I actually want to ask about that printed material later, but who validated the lessons before they were disseminated? Could you move an urgent lesson before the evidence was complete?
Well, this is a good question because my first argument with the chief of army was exactly about this. He wanted, and I understand him, to be the authority who approve every lesson. very quickly understood that this was impossible, and he delegated that authority to me. I was very strict about it, and it required me to read a lot and to rewrite quite a few documents. I worked closely with the learning officer in the corps, division, and the regional commands before any lesson was distributed. The trust between us was important, and the fact that that all of us were recognized professional authorities and close to the to our commanders help us succeed. I made every effort not to advance lesson before we had solid fact. However, in urgent cases, we did so only with the commander's approval.
Can you take us through one lesson from beginning to end, the incident that exposed a problem, how you your team learned about it, how you confirmed what happened, and how that lesson reached other units?
Well, in the first week of the ground maneuver, one of the most difficult incident of the maneuver occurred. A Hamas cell emerged from a tunnel from shaft and fired an RPG at an APC carrying an infantry force. The APC was destroyed and all the soldiers were killed. And the AAR produced two main lessons. First, change the way the area is secure. Whenever the advance stopped and delay, the infantry forces must dismount from the APC, search the nearby buildings, and prevent the enemy from getting close enough to fire at the vehicle at short range. The second lesson was the APC destroyed because the rocket hit the anti-tank weapon stored inside it. So the order was immediately requiring those weapons to be carried outside the APC. We received the lesson because we participated in the incident's AAR. We then passed the lesson and the regional commander's order to all units in several ways. In written format, we had several methods for distributing short, easy to read written products. I will talk about it later. In daily situation assessment and during in inspections of forces where we checked that the new orders were being implemented and that the troops knew the lesson.
How long did that entire cycle take, sir? How did you know the receiving unit had actually changed its behavior?
Well, it depends on the importance of the lesson. In this case, because of the scale of the casualty and severity of the incident, it happened immediately, the day after the incident. In another incident, when an Air Force UAV accidentally killed two of our soldiers, we moved even faster because a critical issue was at stake, trust between the ground forces and the Air Force, and the Air Force participation in the ground maneuver. Our feedback that behavior had changed came when the phenomenon stopped occurring. For example, during Operation Gideon Chariot, the 2025 maneuver operation, we knew that the lesson from incident in which our troops were blow up inside building Hamas had the booby trap had been implemented when those incidents stopped. Sometimes the learning cycle was short and immediate. Unfortunately, sometimes it took several days or even weeks. We have to be honest, as the work continued and force footage become a major factor, the learning process deteriorated and the cycle become longer and sometimes ineffective.
Sir, I think you're talking about an incident that I wrote about when I wrote about the learning system for the Modern War Institute, where Hamas exploited that time that the Israeli infantry remained inside an armored personnel carrier while the lead vehicle cleared the route. I believe the IDF then paused all operations to create that new dismount procedure you're talking about. What happened inside that learning system during that 24-hour pause?
Well, as I said, this was an event that shocked the entire IDF and also even the political echelon. Many people saw it as a warning from Ukraine and feared we would end up like the Russian army with hundreds of dead in single week. That did not happen because of rapid operational learning and implementation in the field. It's very important to understand it. Here, I need to emphasize something. In this case, the learning was led by commanders, not by the learning officer. We were there to help and support them. As a system, we participated in the AAR, understood the lesson and the directives from the senior chain of command, the brigade commander, division commander, and then commanding general, and then made sure they were disseminated to all forces. This was our main job. We didn't take the decision what should be the lesson learned. We helped them to distribute and to check that every unit got it and understand not to do the same mistake. It is important to note that the Southern commander, General Yaron Finkelman, insisted on holding a daily situation assessment with all division commander that opened with learning session. That was a key for the success, to the success.
Yes, sir. I learned about that afterwards, how it was institutionalized as being a part of the operations process, daily briefings and orders. I found that part of the learning process fascinating, almost separate than the way that we think about them being after operations. You were leading operations with them.
It saved life, definitely.
All right, sir. I want to actually talk about the system that you built and the distribution method. So from my understanding, you use digital messages, of course, secure emails, chat. You actually printed important information out to hand out to soldiers that was delivered in white bags during meals. And of course, you had your learning officers out in all the units that could do a face-to-face contact. What determined which method you would use for a particular lesson?
Well, we published routine lesson in a short format we called 7 a week. Each week, we selected 7 key incidents from the battlefield and compiled them into commander's pocket book. It was brief and to the point. When we wanted to go deeper on a specific topic, for example, guerrilla warfare, we compiled the lesson into a more comprehensive booklet. Occasionally, we focus entirely on a single battle, fully analyze it, lesson, and presenting the material as a battle review. When unit held their own learning events, we compiled the lesson that emerged into lesson learned booklet, which was also distributed to the forces. In addition, there were larger projects that continued over time, such as adapting the lesson from Gaza maneuver to maneuver in Lebanon. Perhaps one of the processes I am most proud of, conducted together with the Northern Command. Beyond collecting the lesson in comprehensive booklet, we also added in-person preparation for all field commander over 6 months of preparation. The feedback from the field was tremendous. One company commander who was wounded in Lebanon was asked about the transition from fighting in Gaza to fighting on the Lebanon front. And he said that the preparation we conduct for his unit were the key to their success and readiness for fighting in a different theater. It is important to say that when we identified subject as problematic areas we were struggling against the enemy, we choose to go deeper and provide more details.
The white bags fascinate me. You sent them out with the food. What did that teach you about matching learning to the rhythm of a unit in combat?
You know, sometimes you are so busy and your subordinate do a brilliant thing and you don't see it. The first time that I heard about the white bags is from you. I didn't know it's white bags. So it's amazing question that's very important to me, because you understand how many people work under my command and did a brilliant job. Because it was an accessible every day way to reach troops who would always need food. It also helped with the boredom troops often faces when they had no phones. And you know, this is the TikTok generation, and spent much of their time deploying in defensive position for days at a time. So the learning material was accessible to them, and it replaced from time to time the smartphone.
Yeah, I think it was fascinating. Learn, you know, the right time to consume important information, undivided attention. Big fan of that.
Of course, the risk is a hard copy, as I said before, information security, because some of those material in hard copy, Hamas succeeded to reach them, and he learned a lot about our TTPs because of that.
I never saw it distributed, but you'd almost want it collected back up with the food to be give them a limited amount of time to review it. But that's important, absolutely, operational security. All right, sir. The learning officer cadre that you built reportedly grew from 10 reserve officers to roughly 150, with officers eventually placed down to the battalion level with the battalion commanders. What caused that expansion, and what kind of officer made an effective learning officer?
Well, there is two reasons. First, it was a successful effort, and people want to be part of success. Second, it was essential. So commanders allocated resources to it, especially personnel. A learning officer must be professional authority. This is the most important thing. Commanders need to see him as someone who understands warfare, both theoretically and practically. Second, he must report directly to the commander, not to the J or S3. Once he is professional, personally appointed by and close to the commander, everybody treat learning as something important and a top priority. He cannot be a postman delivering lessons. You know, I saw in some unit learning officer that just were a postman delivering of lessons. They were not professional, and those unit didn't learn like unit that have learning officer that generate learning by themselves. And this officer has to be someone everyone knows and respect. I realize how much influence I had when battalion and company commander recognized me on the battlefield, even though I didn't know who they were, because you know, I retired from the IDF. They are very young. Usually when you are general, you don't know the battalion and the company commander all over the IDF. It's a big organization. And suddenly, from time to time, when I get inside the battlefield, you understand everybody know you. And at the beginning, I didn't know how. And then you understand they have the material, they read it, and they understand there is someone who do this very important job. No one will share the most intimate operational knowledge with you unless they know you. unless they trust you. Unfortunately, I also saw how publishing my book during the war, a book that had been written before the war, but one chapter, the epilogue, analyzing October 7 failure and the early stage of war, hurt my work. Some commanders began to suspect me and my motivation. So this is very intimate position of trust.
Yes, sir. That's what I saw in it. You know, the ability for the commander to look him in the eye and to know you had valuable information, to trust your information. It reminded me also of what we had for a little while. We did away with it, the asymmetric warfare group of these trained professionals that would come out to units, but a lot different, but I saw some similarities. Yeah.
It's a big tension because, you know, in one hand, you need to be very professional and stick to the truth, to the evidence, not to build a narrative by the lesson learned process. In the other hand, people need to understand your intention, to give you very intimate details. So this tension between the truth and between that you want those commander will give you this intimate information is very hard to handle.
And I mean, I think you covered it, but assuming, does the learning officer need to have combat experience, a personal relationship inside the unit, or freedom from the unit's chain of command? It almost sounds like you covered that, but in case there was, what do you think?
Yeah. Well, combat experience, you know, most of my learning officer, especially in the division level, was a professional with a lot of experience, most of them in the past combat position, like a battalion commander. And it's very essential. It's very important. You cannot bring, you know, you cannot bring an officer that will be the G2 if you don't have a background in intelligence.
So, sir, how did you prevent the system from overwhelming commanders with information? In urban combat, almost every incident can appear urgent to the people involved.
Well, other than the challenge of getting knowledge all the way to the tactical edge, this was probably our biggest challenge. And we didn't always succeed at it. That was the rationale behind 7 and a week. A concise, proposed full summary of lesson. We also coordinated with the corps and division to reduce the volume of material as much as possible. But as I told you before, it was a big challenge because every unit, every corps, every division want to spread as much as he can every lesson learned that he collect from the battlefield. And it was very difficult to control it.
I bet. So this is, you know, of course, an important question to me as the urban guy. What was different about learning in Gaza because the fighting was in urban? Which features of the environment produced the fastest or most consequential change in tactics?
Well, fighting in Gaza in a dense urban environment, saturated with subterranean infrastructure, was difficult, challenging, and often frustrating because sometimes we paid a very heavy price for even very small mistakes. It demanded not only high level of professionalism from the forces, but also strong operational discipline and creative solution, given the IDF built-in gap caused by a lack of long-term force development for subterranean warfare. Those mistakes we did before the war. The fastest changes came when we paid the heavy price or failed. That was always the strongest motivator for the forces to improve.
Were the hardest problems created by that density, the rubble, the vertical threats, civilians, tunnels, or the interaction among them all?
Well, the number one problem in Gaza was the tunnels. We found good solution to all other problems, unfortunately, because the lack of pre-war force development and insufficient force development during the war. For subterranean warfare, the solution we had were not good or robust enough. Of course, the combination of all of the challenges together made the tunnel problem even harder. As example, sizing Beit Hanun, small town in the northern part of Gaza Strip, when it was destroyed above ground, while an entire underground city beneath it remained intact, was the hardest challenge of the war. And this is why, in the end, we conquered Beit Hanun 4 times. And only the last time we succeeded to defeat the Hamas battalion over there.
That's amazing. That's actually the next question was about the, you know, the surface and the underground can't be treated as separate battlefields. How did those lessons about tunnels move between, you know, engineers, infantry, armor, intel units, and the formations that had yet to encounter the same underground problems?
On the surface, it sounds very simple. One unit held all the operational knowledge and served as what we call the knowledge hub for all forces. That unit was Yalom, the IDF Special Operation Combat Engineering Unit. But it was not that simple. Not everyone understood it. The unit was not large enough for the scale of the challenge, almost 800 kilometers of tunnel, even more than the tube infrastructure in London. And it was under enormous pressure. There are many examples of how tunnel lesson learned change the way unit operated above the ground. Units that quickly understood that the pace of advance above and below the ground had to be synchronized. The terrain had to be analyzed underground as well, and that support by fire and flanking had to be applied underground as well. Succeeded. Unit that struggled to learn and implement this paid a heavy price, especially along rare logistical routes, because Hamas used those tunnels to ambush logistic echelon along those routes.
Having now visited, you know, I visited 7 times, knew that the IDF had to repeatedly enter, clear in some portion, hold a little ground, but then they eventually would leave for a variety of reasons, from political down to tactical, and then sometimes have to return to those same areas. How did they learn about the differences between clearing a location, controlling it, when Hamas could move through tunnels or reappear among the population?
Well, first, regarding the population, we solved that problem at the beginning of the war. We took away the human shield Hamas relied on and evacuated the civilian population from every combat area we entered, while improving over time in our ability to do so effectively. But Hamas had tunnels. After the first ceasefire, Hamas changed its fighting method from organized defense to guerrilla warfare. So it no longer challenges the IDF during the phases of sizing the area, but only in second phase, when we began operation to clear the area of Hamas infrastructure and operatives. Units that excelled in operational discipline alongside learning and lesson learned process for subterranean warfare succeeded and handled the challenge well. Unit with low level of operational discipline and knowledge of subterranean warfare failed and paid a heavy price. It also took us a year to understand that we must not abandon area we had captured, even after we had cleared them. In Jebalia and Bet Hanun, two big, Bet Hanun, it's a big town in the northern part of Gaza Strip, as I said. Jebalia is a big refugee camp. We paid a heavy price for leaving area and then having to return to them in more than one, two, even three times.
What changes were required on how units handed terrain off to each other or recorded what they had found inside buildings or with the tunnels and shafts?
Well, absolutely. Those units need to handle the area with knowledge, with lesson learned. And when that didn't happen, the new unit had to start everything from scratch and paid a very heavy price in relearning and unfortunately casualties. So you need to give the information about which operation you operate and which infrastructure you found, and especially which houses you capture before and which route you use before, because when we evacuate this area and new unit get inside, Hamas knew which houses we capture, which route we use, and of course he put booby traps for all of these houses and all of these routes, preparing himself to the new battle with the new force that will capture this area. So the information from unit to unit was very, very important.
So I know different units, different missions matter. How did the learning system handle combined arms problems? So especially the relationship between armor and infantry, combat engineers and their D9 bulldozers, the drones, fires, and intel in a narrow urban terrain.
In the simplest way possible, the learning system and the learning network were combined, armed, and joined. We had an excellent permanent team that worked together throughout the entire war and conducted combined, armed, and joint learning process. This was the best war the IDF has ever conducted in terms of implementing lessons from previous war, conducting combined armed and joint maneuver in which the whole was greater than the sum of its part.
I know this would be difficult, but for urban warfare, what relationship improved the most during the war and which remained difficult even after repeated operations?
Without question, cooperation between the ground forces and the air force, and the air force participation in the ground maneuver. First, that happened because of years of force development based on lesson from the 2006 Lebanon War. The second reason was the trust built between senior commanders in the air force and senior commanders in the ground forces. Quite unusually, I did not see any area of cooperation during the war that did not become tighter and improve over time. I think the IDF in this profession was in its best.
So, of course, Hamas was learning at the same time. How did you identify any enemy adaptation before it became a recurring pattern across Gaza?
Hamas is an organization that excels at learning. And the learning competition against it was hard and challenging. It is particularly good at identifying change and, more than anything, at adapting and institutionalizing what it learned. At the system level, it took us time to identify the change that developed after the first ceasefire, when Hamas shift to guerrilla warfare. Their learning competition kept evolving all the time. And as example, during Operation Gideon Chariot, we quickly identify booby trap, as I told you before, building as the leading enemy pattern, and we solve the problem very quickly through learning. The next stage was that Hamas learned how to fight in destroyed terrain using the rubble to attack us at close range. We find solution to that challenge as well. It was a constant competition.
And now I know you said about the white bags, and one of them left, or some of it left behind, and Hamas targeted. But was there a point when Hamas began targeting the IDF learning cycle itself by changing its tactics before a response could spread?
Oh, it's a good and a hard question. I don't remember anything like that. Once Hamas shifted to guerrilla warfare, it no longer really need to do so, I think. It preferred to exploit the gains it had already achieved. Changing the cycle was, so to speak, I think, a luxury for rich. Nothing that Hamas need to do or able to do.
So what lesson proved to be very specific to a neighborhood or a phase or an enemy technique versus a lesson that traveled successfully from Gaza to operations in Lebanon or Syria?
Well, as I said before, we conducted a comprehensive preparation process that lasted several months in order to adapt the lesson to the northern theater. Some lessons were relevant, such as TTPs for sizing buildings suspected of being booby trapped. Some techniques were not relevant, such as the way we dealt with subterranean warfare, because the ground in Lebanon is rocky rather than sandy like Gaza. But the greatest emphasis was on lessons that would have been dangerous to apply and therefore must not be applied in the northern arena. For example, the way we deployed tanks and bulldozer in Lebanon was completely different from Gaza.
I guess that would be, how did you avoid that, assuming that method developed for Gaza terrain would work unchanged in Hezbollah, and that with, especially with the different urban and subterranean network?
We use the past experience of many IDF officers that fought in South Lebanon against Hezbollah to validate all the lessons and detailed them in a booklet titled From Gaza Strip to Northern Command. In Hebrew, it sounds better. In addition, it's sketchy in Hebrew. In English, it doesn't sound catchy. In addition, every unit that moved from the south to the north went through a preparation process focused on the differences between the theater. We used a metaphor. The metaphor was, it like moving from an indoor futsal court to a massive outdoor football stadium. Company commander that wounded in Lebanon that I talk about him, talk about this metaphor a lot. He said, the metaphor gave me the opportunity to understand this is a different battlefield and the terrain shape everything.
Yeah, I bet. You said it was from an indoor basketball court to an outdoor football field? Is that the metaphor?
You know, I use a presentation with two pictures in the opening slide. Small pitch, indoor, and I took the picture of the Camp Nou, Barcelona Stadium in for football. So okay. I told them, listen, imagine that you are moving for your small pitch in your base to play in Barcelona, in the Camp Nou, or in, I don't know, Old Trafford or Anfield. It's the same game, but it's totally different.
Okay, sir. So I'm running out of time and I have hours of conversation or questions that I want to ask. Let me ask you this one, which is might be hard for you, but of course it's important for me as I've done all my trips and writing on my own lesson learned report on the of all my visits. If the U.S. Army wanted to develop an equivalent capability, what should be permanent before the next war? Like the people, the network, the doctrine, or the authority to change practice during combat of this learning system?
The most important thing is culture. A culture that enables learning. The ability to argue and to hear different opinions. The understanding that learning is a real line of effort that commanders must conduct during combat. And the ability to adapt and change while fighting. You know, you can understand something, manufacture lesson learned, but you are not fast in adapting this lesson learned, so the lesson is not relevant. And the big challenge the IDF had during this war with Hezbollah and with Hamas, they know how to manufacture the lesson learned, but more than that, they have very fast process to adapt those lesson learned. Because, you know, they are not regular forces. They are terror, guerrilla organization. It's for them, you know, they have less bureaucrat procedure than regular forces, so it's easy to them. Though for us as a regular forces, for United States Army, this is a big challenge, and you need to practice this during exercise and, of course, to build infrastructure that will support the commander, as the IDF did during the war, to do this process.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Organizational culture. But there's so much here and why I wrote about it and why I wanted to talk to you from the learning officers in the commander's staff, a trusted individual, to the distribution collection process, to the, I mean, I love the mealtime letter, even the institutionalizing it into the operations process where the commander starts the daily update with the lesson learned and into the operation process. All of it, I think, would greatly benefit the U.S. military to be able to learn truly what I believe at the speed of urban warfare, which is a unique type of complexity. So the million-dollar question, sir, what is the single most important lesson you learned about how armies learn during urban warfare?
Wow, this is a hard question. I think it is a universal lesson relevant to every type of warfare. Failure, more than success, is the fuel for the learning engine. Therefore, in training, we have to study the pathology of failure and constantly conduct failure exercise. When I was a brigade commander, I conduct a failure exercise to one of my battalion. And in the end of the exercise, when I was in my car back home, I called to the battalion commander and apologized about the exercise. I told him, listen, I don't feel comfortable. I think it was tough, too tough. And it was unfair exercise. And then he told me, listen, Guy, this was one of the best exercise that we ever did. The commanders in my battalion, we just finished our debrief of this exercise, told me we never learn as we learn during this exercise because the challenge the brigade commander gave us. So I think it's something that's very important to do, because usually, you know, and it's up to the culture of the organization, of the society that you come from. It's very difficult to decide that you are going to do an exercise that in the end, it will be totally failure. Because, you know, you want to build a confidence inside your commander, but confidence sometimes you build from commanders that understand how is it to fail and what are you doing when you are failed in the battlefield. The problem that if you will meet a failure first time in the battlefield, you don't know what to do.
Yeah, you have to let them fail. And I also deeply believe in that, but I also believe in learning from other people's failures. So I'm hoping listeners will take so much from this episode to include what you learned from some of the failures tactically, but even organizationally. Sir, I can't thank you enough for joining my podcast. Again, General Guy Hazzout, his new book, New Guard, No Guard, How Israel Built the World's Most Advanced Military by Dismantling Its Own Ground Forces, but also the IDF Chief Learning Officer for the Ground Forces. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, John, for the opportunity and for a fascinating conversation. The book will be available on Amazon in a month. Right now, it can only be obtained in a hard copy through my website, Guy Hazzout with doubleho.com. And hope to see you soon again in Israel.
I'll be back soon, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast. The podcast is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of their participants and do not represent the positions of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. You can subscribe to the Urban Warfare Project podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And be sure to check out NWI's other podcasts, as well as the new articles we're publishing every day on our website. Thanks again for listening.